The headlines this hour. Press TV celebrates 15 years of relentless news coverage and remaining true to its mandate, despite facing numerous restrictions. Iran's foreign minister is in Damascus as part of diplomatic efforts to boost regional stability. Also coming up, Israeli fighter jets strike Syria's Mediterranean coast with several missiles. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's International English Language News Network, Press TV, is celebrating the 15th anniversary. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali tells us more on the history of the news network since its launch in 2007.
To bring you stories that the mainstream media won't tell you.
The voice of the voiceless has been its motto since it was launched in 2007. Press TV now celebrates its 15th birthday.
Well, first of all, I'd like to congratulate all my colleagues here at Press TV. And this is a really exciting 15 years, I mean, because we've seen so many challenges along the way, so many blocks that have been put in front of us trying to stop us from broadcasting the truth. But fortunately, this is the 15th year, and we will go stronger than ever.
Press TV's motto arises from the narrative of the Islamic Republic, which seeks to raise the voice of the oppressed, the voice of the voiceless. This policy can attract many audience from around the world.
We search.
We explore.
We discover.
To bring you nothing but authentic news.
Affiliated to the World Service of Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, Press TV is Iran's only English language news network, reflecting some of the major developments in the world, round the clock. Press TV says its major goal is to shine a new light on stories that are either untold, underreported, or misrepresented by mainstream media. A case in point, as put by Press TV, is the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, where the mainstream have been trying to sanctify the Ukrainian army.
Another thing that people don't realize is that there are crimes that are being committed by Ukraine itself in terms of areas that they are bombarding that has led to civilian deaths. We're not promoting war. Definitely that's not the stance that the Islamic Republic has. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that both sides are relayed in terms of the actual facts and for it not to be skewed.
To raise the voice of the voiceless, Press TV has faced many challenges. It was taken off air many times. It was also banned by Google from operating on social media platforms such as YouTube. In one of the latest measures, the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation seized Press TV's .com domain in what Press TV describes as an attempt to pull the plug on the truth.
All of these measures are taken on the part of the West to muzzle the alternative voices and prevent them from reaching the audience. It has turned into a complicated war of narratives, and we have not been passive. We are working to get our message across.
Press TV, Istanbul.
To unearth the truth, Press TV has also lost some of its dedicated journalists, namely Serena Shem, Maya Nasser, Habibullah Hussainzadeh, and Farhad Taqaddusi. Now, as we mark the 15th birthday of Press TV, we would like to share our happiness with our fellow Press TV journalists, who are no longer among us.
To challenge the narratives of the mainstream, Press TV had to swim against the stream. This has not been easy for the past 15 years, but as long as its audiences are growing in number, Press TV says it will carry on giving voice to the voiceless. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Researcher and activist Hossein Shekhian believes that Press TV plays an important role as a counter-hegemonic media outlet, and that is why it is always targeted by Western powers.
In fact, the definition of alternative media, if we consider, and I think we should consider the Press TV as an alternative media, the definition is to challenge the dominant beliefs and values of a culture, and it has been described as it's like more than, I mean, it's like a counter-hegemonic media. by the, as the scholar says. So the problem begins exactly at this point, the point that you confront the hegemony and the single culture that they want to make via their medias. It begins at exactly at this point where you tend to be an anti-hegemony, anti-dominance, anti-world culture that has been created by dominance too. Therefore, Press TV is not a simple TV channel who tells the story and the news and programs, but it's a voice. It's a voice that rebels against the system, which is dominance the world. And that's not bearable. That's not, they cannot tolerate it, obviously. You see what they have done to this channel during these 15 years, blocking and censoring and deleting and etc. It is what the so-called democratic world of the freedom of speech has done to this channel. And I think that's a success. What is success? This standing against the mainstream, this is standing against the powers.
Barry Grossman is an international lawyer and a political analyst who has been sharing his thoughts on global issues with Press TV viewers for over a decade now. He believes that Press TV is one of the very few media organizations offering various individuals a platform to express their views without any interference.
Press TV is one of the few media organizations out there that essentially gives people with alternative views or different views, different from what the corporate media cartel would have people believe. It gives them a platform for expressing those views without any interference whatsoever. And I can say in my quite a few years now, certainly more than 10 years of experience with Press TV, and I think this is very important. No one has ever made any effort to tell me what to say or to find out what I'm going to say on a particular issue. And I think this is very important, given that what we hear repeatedly from countries like the United States is complaints about Press TV being government funded, as though the United States doesn't have a very broad range of media outlets which are entirely government funded as well. It just makes no sense that Press TV allows various individuals, often with quite different views, to express those views without necessarily embracing those views, or without those views necessarily in any way reflecting the views of the Iranian political establishment. And there are very few media organizations in the world right now that are committed to doing that. And the U.S. is fully committed and has publicly made it clear that it's fully committed to taking advantage of the situation of being what it considers the sole superpower in the world in order to push forward with a U.S. sort of global hegemony, where the U.S. is uniquely in a position to define what they call the international rules-based system, the international order, without necessarily embracing any of those rules themselves, because they're, of course, far too exceptional. And without organizations like Press TV affording an opportunity to people like me and our other guests and the various other people who from time to time appear on Press TV to take issue with that, I think we would find that there are a great deal fewer people in the world who are aware of the changes that are being forced through even as we speak.
Iran's foreign minister says his trip to Syria is aimed at promoting peace and security in the region. Prior to his departure for Damascus, Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that he also intends to ease tensions between Syria and Turkey. The top diplomat noted that Iran should play its constructive role and fend off new crises in the West Asia region. During his trip, Amir Abdollahian will hold discussions with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and top officials on bilateral ties, as well as a range of regional and international issues. Israel conducts fresh airstrikes on Syria, firing several missiles at the southern part of the second-largest Mediterranean port city of Tartus. At least two civilians have been injured. The Syrian Defense Ministry says the missiles hit poultry farms near the town of Hamidiya that were fired from the Mediterranean Sea. Israel frequently targets areas inside the crisis-hit Arab country. The attacks mainly target positions of resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorist groups. Syria has time and again denounced Israeli acts of aggression and has lodged official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. Damascus says it reserves the right to respond to the Israeli aggression. Moving on to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine, which is grinding through its fifth month. Fierce fighting is underway in Ukraine's east as Russian forces push to gain control of the Donbas region. Russian troops and their allies have completely encircled the flashpoint city of Lysychansk, the last major Ukrainian holdout in Luhansk province. That's according to a spokesman for the pro-Russia forces. The new development comes 1 week after the Russian army took over the neighboring city of Severodonetsk, marking Kiev's biggest battlefield setback for the past month. To the south, powerful explosions rocked Mykolaiv early on Saturday. Local authorities say that the reason for the blast is unknown. On Friday, 21 people were killed when missiles hit an apartment building in the southern Odessa region. Ukrainian officials blame Russia, but Moscow denies striking the building. And staying with Ukraine, as Russia continues to make gains in the Donbas region, Johnny Miller has traveled to the frontline city of Gorlovka and reports on the situation there.
The town of Olomskia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as a town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. The boom of outgoing artillery. Two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon, so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 meters or 100 meters around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit these artillery pieces rather than just aiming at civilians.
Incredibly, in this desolate place, some civilians still live here, although most cower inside.
So what is it like to live here?
It's bad, my nerves are shredded and it's always tense. What kind of a state is Ukraine that kills its own people, sending brother against brother? We are hoping soon for victory.
In the adjacent city of Golovka, I meet the well-known mayor, Ivan Pekodko. He uses a Ukrainian flag as the doormat to his office.
This flag lying over there symbolizes the criminal state of Ukraine, not its people. The flag is my personal trophy as well. I took it at the front line. I was born in Donetsk and I loved Ukraine. But those who took power in 2014 in the coup trampled over democracy and they do not care about the citizens of the East.
Who do you blame for the breakup of Ukraine?
The answer is obvious. NATO countries are to blame, in particular the United States. They needed Ukraine as a hotbed of tension at the border with Russia. You see, I'm for democracy. In 2014, they should have asked what people wanted. But nobody was interested in people's opinion. That's why we have got what we have now. We have a terrible war, dead Ukrainians, dead Russians. It's really horrible. And those who draw benefit from it are sitting across the ocean.
While Russia calls this war a special military operation, Ukraine calls it an invasion. But here in Donbass, the pro-Russian civilians call it a liberation operation. With the Russian army making gains not far to the north of these desperate streets, the 8 years of war in this town might finally be set to end. Jenny Milikolovka.
Hundreds of thousands of Muslims from all corners of the world have congregated in the city of Mecca to visit the Holy Kaaba. The first step to begin their pilgrimage is a particular state of purification and sanctity known as Ihram. Mahdi Abbasian has a report from Mecca.
As hundreds of thousands of Muslims embark upon a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they must enter a particular state of purification and sanctity known as the Ihram. In Arabic, Ihram means prohibition and a state of holiness.
Ihram and Miqat are like a runway for planes. If one wants to ascend, he'd better use this runway. You can't do it from anywhere else.
Ihram is an obligatory prerequisite to Hajj. Muslims stop at a designated station to perform the rituals associated with wearing ihram. The stations of Miqat are the five prescribed places for ihram, located at different directional corners from the holy city of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Pilgrims perform ablution and cleanse their bodies. Then they wear ihram and make niyat, the intention of performing Hajj. Men are required to wear two pieces of white cloth that are unadorned and plain. Women are not required to conform to a specific dress code, but have to dress modestly. It is crucial to ensure that the clothes are neat and tidy.
In addition to its facade, Hajj has an essence. We must find out the essence of the act of wearing ihram. This attire signifies the removal of any impurity or unclean aspect from our body and soul.
We wear ihram to abstain from sins we have committed in the past and get closer to God. After wearing ihram, Muslims are prohibited from a number of acts.
Ihram also resembles the shroud used to wrap dead bodies before they are buried. Therefore, it's a reminder of how death comes unannounced and does not discriminate between anyone.
There are different stages in Hajj that are like wake-up calls for us in our lives. Ihram reminds us of the afterlife and that our existence would not perish after death.
After cleansing their bodies and wearing ihram, Muslims get ready for the journey to the holy city of Mecca and they will visit Kaaba. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The New York Times reports that Ukraine is crawling with special forces and spies from the U.S. and its allies, which would seem to contradict earlier reports that the U.S. intelligence cartel is having trouble getting intel about what's happening on the ground in Ukraine. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Caitlin A. Johnston, journalist. This article is published under the heading Western officials admit Ukraine is crawling with CIA personnel. Stay tuned for more. The New York Times reports that Ukraine is crawling with special forces and spies from the U.S. and its allies, which would seem to contradict earlier reports that the U.S. intelligence cartel is having trouble getting intel about what's happening on the ground in Ukraine. This would also obviously put the final nail in the coffin of the claim that this is not a U.S. proxy war. In an article titled "Commando Network Coordinates Flow of Weapons in Ukraine," officials say anonymous Western officials inform us of the following through their stenographers at the New York Times. As Russian troops press ahead, the nation's ability to resist the onslaught depends more than ever on help from the United States and its allies, including a stealthy network of commandos and spies rushing to provide weapons, intelligence, and training, according to U.S. and European officials. Much of this work happens outside Ukraine at bases in Germany, France, and Britain, for example. But even as the Biden administration has declared it will not deploy American troops to Ukraine, some CIA personnel have continued to operate in the country secretly, mostly in the capital Kiev, directing much of the massive amounts of intelligence the United States is sharing with Ukrainian forces, according to current and former officials, unquote. Adding, at the same time, a few dozen commandos from other NATO countries, including Britain, France, Canada, and Lithuania, also have been working inside Ukraine, unquote. The revelation that the CIA and U.S. Special Forces are conducting military operations in Ukraine does indeed make a lie of the Biden administration's insistence at the start of the war that there would be no American boots on the ground in Ukraine, and the admission that NATO powers are so involved in operations against a nuclear superpower means we are closer to seeing a nuclear exchange than anyone should be comfortable with, unquote. This news should surprise no one who knows anything about the usual behavior of the U.S. intelligence cartel, but interestingly, it contradicts something we were told by the same New York Times not 3 weeks ago. Quote, American intelligence agencies have less information than they would like about Ukraine's operations and possess a far better picture of Russia's military, its planned operations and its successes and failures, NYT told us earlier this month. U.S. officials said the Ukrainian government gave them few classified briefings or details about their operational plans, and Ukrainian officials acknowledged that they did not tell the Americans everything, unquote. It seems a bit unlikely that U.S. intelligence agencies would have a hard time getting information about what's happening in a country where they themselves are physically located. Moon of Alabama theorized at a time that this ridiculous "we don't know what's happening in our own proxy war" line was being pushed to give the U.S. plausible deniability about Ukraine's failures on the battlefield which have only gotten worse since then. So, why are they telling us all this now? Well, it could be that we are being paced into accepting an increasingly direct role of the US and its allies in Ukraine. The other day, anti-war's Daniel Larrison tweeted, "Hawks in April, don't call it a proxy war. Hawks in May, of course it's a proxy war. Hawks in June, it's not their war, it's our war." This is indeed exactly how it happened. Back in April, President Biden told the press the idea that this is a proxy war between the US and Russia was not true, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said it's not, this is clearly Ukraine's fight, when asked if this is a proxy war. Then May rolled around and all of a sudden we had the New Yorker unequivocally telling us that the US is in a full proxy war with Russia and hawks like US Congressman Seth Moulton, saying things like, "We are not just at war to support the Ukrainians, we are fundamentally at war, although somewhat through a proxy with Russia, and it's important that we win," unquote. And now here in June, we've got war hawks like Max Boot coming right out and saying that this is actually America's war, and it is therefore important for the US to drastically escalate the war in order to hand the Russians devastating losses. So the previously unthinkable idea that the US is at war with Russia has been gradually normalized, with the heat turned up so slowly that the frog doesn't notice it's being boiled alive. If that idea can be sufficiently normalized, public concern for greater escalations will likely be forthcoming, even if those escalations are extremely psychotic.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the things that you see in the teachings of the Urafan, these are taken from the Ahadith, I want to share the Ahadith, is that instead of it being 0 to 60, because you know the first part of our talk is the idea of the Ahkam reminder, right? And it should be part of that everybody is becoming more and more aware of the ahkam, the rulings, in order to show their loyalty to the imam of the time. What happens is, the urafa don't take the 0 to 60 approach when it comes to ahkam. That children, when before I'm 8 and a half, I have nothing, and then suddenly at 9, now you come down to me. What they teach us is this: we as parents, before our children become baligh, we have to teach them the ahkam which they will encounter. So they should know how to, before bulugh, how to fast, how to pray, so before bulugh. In order to do that, one of the things that we have to do, this is us as parents, again, advice from the urafa, is our children need to hear from us and know that one day they will stand before Allah that belief in the hereafter, that there's a last motivation for why I have to do the ahkam. That's something that we as parents need to introduce. Our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was looking at a group of children. When he was looking at this group of children, he said this, وَيْلٌ لِأَوْلَادِ آخِرِ الزَّمَانِ مِنْ آبَائِهِمْ. Woe to the children of the people in the end of times from their fathers. Some of the mu'mineen, the believers, they said, their parents who are mushrikeen, the Prophet said, no, from their parents who are mu'mineen. What is so terrible about those parents in that time? What are we trying to avoid? He said this, لَا يُعَلِّمُونَهُمْ شَيْئًا مِّنَ الْفَرَائِذِ. They haven't taught their children their Islamic responsibilities. And then when the children learn on their own, وَإِذَا تَعَلَّمُوا أَوْلَادُهُمْ, when the children sometimes, they are motivated. That's one of the things that I really like to see in this community that we're in. I meet young people who are personally driven for Islam. The family might even be opposed. The family might not be supportive. But this person has chosen Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It says, وَإِذَا تَعَلَّمُوا أَوْلَادُهُمْ. Sometimes the children learn on their own. The parents, these parents, مَنَعُوهُمْ. They prevent them from practicing Islam. Instead, the hadith continues, they're satisfied with a small, meager amount of the dunya from them. Sometimes worldly achievements. Are you a doctor? Are you a lawyer? Do you have a good job? What do people say about you? It says, شَيْءٌ بِعَرَضٍ يَسِيرٌ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا. Sometimes these small worldly accomplishments are what the parents look for. Instead of what's really count, like Nabi Ya'qub, when he told, don't die unless you're Muslims. The Prophet says that he says, I have nothing to do with them and they have nothing to do with me. The advice we get, from 7 lunar years, our children need to know how to make wudu. From 8, they should be praying regularly. From 8 lunar years. The hadith, Imam Ali says, عَلِّمُوا سِبْيَانَكُمَ الصَّلَاةِ. Teach your children how to pray. وَخُذُوهُمْ بِهَا. After that, you require this from them when they become 8. Then now, I'm not waiting until you're baligh to suddenly say, well, it's wajib. No, you have to start learning and practicing. You already know how to do it. Encouragement. But then at 8, I'm supposed to start requiring this from you. So, again, the Urafa have another statement to make. Remember that first one was the idea of being aware of the hereafter, the day that I'm going to stand before God. What about the motivation for salah? Our children should know I'm talking to God. Salah is that opportunity for me to address my Lord. The Urafa have advice over here, though. They say that our children need to learn from us about praying at the first time. Do our children see us rush through the prayer? What they're going to pick up is more from our actions than our words. The hadith says this, lisanul hal, our current state, the state that we're in, asdaqu min lisanil maqal. Our actions speak louder than our words. Our current state says a lot more than the words that we utter. If we want to train children to be the soldiers of the Imam of the time, how are we when it comes to our prayers? Do we pray? Do we take our time? Do we act as if we're talking to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? What about fasting? Fasting, they say, is a little bit different. When our boys, because our girls become baligh at 9, when our boys are 9 years old, 9 lunar years old, they're supposed to be fasting for the month of Ramadan. However, these fasts are such that the Ahlul Bayt teach us, they say that once they get hungry or thirsty, at that stage you let the children break their fast. It might be before Dhuhr, it might be, right? But just the idea of slowly, slowly getting used to it. Not that I end up, I've missed fast, qadha, kafara. Because nobody just explained to me how important these things were. So the Ahlul Bayt, the first part of the ahadith, which I'm not going to mention, the Ahlul Bayt say, what was our practice with our children? Then after that they say, what should your practice be? It says, so command your children, when they, your boys, when they become 9, bisawm, to fast. Mastata'u min siyam al-yawm. So the amount that they're able to. And then when they become very thirsty, then at that stage you allow them to break their fast. So, that's a little bit about that. The last part is the akhlaqi reminder. And the akhlaqi reminder is actually a trait that's very important for us to develop. And ideally, we want to develop this trait while we're still young. There's never an excuse for misbehaving. I can never say, well, I'm accustomed to doing this way. But what we hear from Imam Khomeini is the idea that if you start working on yourself while you're young, it's a lot easier. So, we talked before about the concept of working with a teacher, trying to make sure that we're receiving that one-on-one training. We're going to cover another one of those kind of big picture concepts and then inshallah jump right in. So one of the big picture concepts is the idea of listening to maw'idha. If I want to work on developing myself, one of the things that I want to expose myself to is I want to hear, I want to come to sessions like this or like other sessions that are there where I'm exposed to the teachings of Islam. Even if it's repetition, I want to hear it again and again. What we hear from our senior ulama. I want to give the example of Shaykh Al-A'zam Ansari. So Shaykh Ansari, as you know, was one of the greatest of our fuqaha who ever lived. One of the greatest of our maraja. We've talked before, I've shared before some of his spiritual station and how when he would visit Amir al-Mu'mineen, sometimes he would know when Imam Mahdi is there. And if the Imam gave permission, he would come in. This man used to sit at the feet of one of his students and hear mu'idha. Imam Khomeini, may Allah have mercy on his soul, would also, Imam Khomeini, who all of us know, he wanted to hear mu'idha, to be part of the audience I'm hearing from his student.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, vice chair of the Congressional Panel investigating the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol, has warned that former President Donald J. Trump represents a domestic threat that we have never faced before. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Explosive Testimony Piles Pressure on Trump, How Likely Are Criminal Charges? Six televised hearings, the House January 6 committee has presented extraordinary testimony about Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election and its culmination, the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol by a far-right mob. The committee is made up of 7 Democrats and 2 rebel Republicans, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, who refused to follow their party in bending the knee to Donald Trump. Set free of bipartisan considerations when the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy withdrew cooperation, the panel has been able to act in a purely prosecutorial manner. It has also worked on how to present its findings, using television industry expertise to present hearings honed, contained, and aimed at convincing the American public that Donald Trump should never be president again. The committee cannot charge Donald Trump with a crime, but the U.S. Department of Justice can, a possibility that has stoked intense speculation in Washington and the world. But here are the key legal issues. Can the committee make criminal referrals? Yes, it has done so in the cases of Steve Bannon, Peter Navarro, Mark Meadows and Dan Scavino, Donald Trump aides who refused to cooperate with the committee. Pleading not guilty to criminal contempt of Congress, Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro faced time in prison. The Department of Justice declined to charge Dan Scavino and Mark Meadows. Will the committee refer Donald Trump? The chair of the House committee, Benny Thompson of Mississippi, has said he does not expect to do so. However, that statement prompted reports of disagreement on the House panel and also came before Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the panel, revealed possible attempts to intimidate witnesses. On Wednesday, CNN asked the committee member, Pete Aguilar of California, if he believed witness tampering had occurred. Pete Aguilar said, "Yes, I do. I think that's something that should be looked at by our committee and potentially by the Department of Justice." Asked if a referral had been made, Pete Aguilar said, "I'm not going to talk about the investigative steps we have taken, but what I will say is I think that those statements speak for themselves as evidence of dangerous behavior." One of the witness statements, which Liz Cheney read on Tuesday, 28th of June, was reportedly made by Cassidy Hutchinson, a former close aide to Donald Trump and to Mark Meadows, who testified for 2 dramatic hours. Could the Department of Justice charge Donald Trump? The House committee has turned up extensive evidence that suggests a case could be made. Cassidy Hutchinson appeared to draw Trump closer to strong links with extremist groups which attacked the Capitol, saying she recalled hearing the word Oath Keeper and hearing the word Proud Boys closer to the planning of the January 6 rally, when Rudy Giuliani would be around the White House. Rudy Giuliani was Donald Trump's personal attorney. Among more than 870 people charged over the Capitol attack, members of the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys have been charged with seditious conspiracy. But to many, One passage in Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony seemed to draw Trump the closest yet to demonstrable criminal conduct. Hutchinson said Donald Trump knew the crowd for his speech near the White House on 6th of January 2021 contained armed individuals, some with AR-15 rifles and handguns, but still told his audience to march onto the Capitol and fight like hell to stop certification of election results. Donald Trump told the crowd he would march with them and, according to Secret Service witnesses, was furious to be denied the opportunity. David French, senior editor at The Dispatch and the author of Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation, wrote, Cassidy Hutchinson's sworn testimony closes a gap in the criminal case against Donald Trump, and Trump is closer to a credible prosecution than ever before. As David French described, Donald Trump's actions on and around 6th of January 2021 appear to meet standards for prosecution set in a 1969 Supreme Court case, Brandenburg v. Ohio, which involved a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Then, the court overturned Brandenburg's conviction, holding that even speech that threatened violence or disorder was protected by the First Amendment unless such advocacy is directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. David French wrote, Note the elements of intentionality, likelihood and imminence. The imminence element is easiest to justify, to satisfy. The mob was right there. It marched to the Capitol right away, even as Donald Trump was speaking. But what about intentionality and likelihood? In David French's view, Donald Trump demonstrably summoned the mob, knew it was armed and dangerous, and told it to fight like hell, and tried to march with it. He then inflamed it further with a tweet in which he derided Mike Pence, his vice president, for not supporting his scheme. Is the Department of Justice investigating Donald Trump? Yes. This week, the New York Times profiled Thomas Wyndham, an aggressive, if little-known federal prosecutor who is pulling together the disparate strands of Department of Justice Trump investigations. According to the New York Times, Wyndham, a 44-year-old, is working under the close supervision of Attorney General Merrick Garland's top aides and executing the department's time-tested, if slow-moving strategy are working from the periphery of the events inwards. As examples of such work, the paper mentioned a raid on a former Department of Justice employee's house and the seizure of a phone belonging to John Eastman, the law professor who cooked up Donald Trump's scheme to reject Electoral College results. Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony also increased the heat on Donald Trump's closest aides. Punchbowl News noted that though the Department of Justice declined to charge Mark Meadows for defying the January 6th committee, following more damning testimony on Meadows' role in everything leading to the insurrection, the Department of Justice could rethink that position. The Department of Justice does appear to be closing the net on Donald Trump. Whether it chooses to haul in such a big fish is a very big question indeed. So will Trump be indicted? As David French wrote, criminal charges require both evidence and political will. He said, the evidence against Trump continues to mount, both in Washington, D.C. and in Georgia, where there is substantial evidence supporting both federal and state charges for his effort to threaten and intimidate Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find 12,000 votes. Raffensperger has appeared with other Republican state officials before the January 6th committee, providing damning testimony of his own. Most observers agree that for the Department of Justice to indict a former president and that a potential presidential candidate in 2024 would set a dangerous precedent, particularly given Donald Trump's strong and demonstrably violent following on the far right. But David French wrote, there is another precedent that is perhaps more grave and more dangerous, deciding that presidents are held to lower standards of criminal behavior than virtually any other American citizen. But what does Liz Cheney think that the Department of Justice should do? The Wyoming Republican's anti-Trump stance seems set to cost her a seat in Congress. Regardless, on Wednesday, 29th of June, she tweeted David French's words to the world. The same day, Liz Cheney went to the Republican Holy of Holies, the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. Describing a domestic threat that we have never faced before, the daughter of Dick Cheney, George W. Bush's vice president, told her party, to argue that the threat posed by Donald Trump can be ignored is to cast aside the responsibility that every citizen, every one of us, bears to perpetuate the Republic. She said, we must not do that, and we cannot do that.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. As for his school of thought, principles and goals, if we wish to briefly explain the foundation of Imam's school of thought and revolution, We must say that the foundation for all his activities was rising up for the cause of God. The goal was to rise for the cause of God. This is one goal, and another is to administer justice. This is the second goal, and the third goal is to promote spirituality. These are the goals. I have written down Quranic ayahs in this regard. You can refer to Quranic index Al-Mu'jam in the form Iqamah. There it becomes clear what this uprising is for. For example, so that people may administer justice, chapter 57, verse 25, in which the purpose of sending prophets and divine books is said to be, so that people may administer justice. This is one ayah. Another ayah is in Holy Surah An-Nisa, as well as standing up for orphans' rights. Chapter 4, verse 127.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another ayah is in Surah Al-Rahman, Way with Justice, chapter 55, verse 9. And another ayah is in Surah Al-Shura, in chapter Al-Shura, Uphold the Faith, that is chapter 42, verse 13. Another ayah is in Surah Al-Ma'idah, You have nothing to stand on unless you observe the Torah, the Gospel, chapter 5, verse 68. And many ayahs in the Quran, and rise in prayers, chapter 2, verse 43. The rising for the cause of God must lead to these things. This is the purpose of rising up for the cause of God. I said that Imam was a fighter. This means that Imam was continuously present in the arena of rising for the cause of God. Imam was truly vigilant about rising for the cause of God. The establishment of the truth and justice was naturally Imam's goal.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.